Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
We're stepped out upon the world stage now, with the fate of human dignity in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment now.
That is actor Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln in the 2012 biopic, Lincoln. He is talking to his cabinet about the need to enact the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. Abraham Lincoln's legacy as the great emancipator is a symbol claimed by politicians from both sides of the aisle. That's what we're talking about today. Louis P. Mazur is Distinguished Professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. He wrote the 2014 biography, Lincoln's 100 Days, The Emancipation Proclamation and the War for Union, which won the Lincoln Institute Book Prize. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And Jennifer Weber is an associate professor and Lincoln scholar at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. The views expressed are those of Dr. Weber. They do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of Defense, the U.S. government, U.S. Air Force Academy, or U.S. Air Force. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
David Reynolds is a distinguished professor at the Graduate Center of the City's University of New York. His latest book is the 2020 biography, Abe, Abraham Lincoln in His Times. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
David Reynolds, in the first chapter, you quote a newspaper editor of the day telling a large dinner audience that Lincoln was the first typical American. And I loved that reference. What does that mean then? And does it still hold true now?
Well, the whole issue of what was the average or typical American had been brought up at that dinner. That was in the 1880s. And somebody got up and said that Lincoln combined the Puritan and the Cavalier. A lot of people back then had the legend of that the Civil War was really about two civilizations, the so-called Cavalier Southern civilization and the Puritan New England one. They were both settled by different classes from, particularly from England. And it so happens that Lincoln on his father's side went back to early Puritan New England. Samuel Lincoln came over in 1637. And then on his father's side, there was illegitimacy. He wasn't sure, who his ancestor was, but he knew he was descended from a Virginia planter. So, and biographers after his death kind of probed a little bit. And he was aware of those, although he didn't like to emphasize them because he didn't like to separate the wires and so forth, the Puritan versus Cavalier. And he mentioned Quakers in his background. He actually only had one Quaker, but that was a more moderate kind of middle ground. But yeah, so that at that dinner in 1886, Henry Grady said, he was the combination of the Cavalier and the Puritan and the average American.
Because before that, people tended to identify with one or the other or one region of the country over the other.
Yeah, he became kind of a gesture of reconciliation because in the 1880s and 90s, there was this big idea of reunion. Okay, let's bury the hatchet between the North and the South. And okay, we were once at war, but now let's, and that's when the Confederate monuments went up and when even in the very racist film called Birth of a Nation, it's very rare. They make a god out of the Ku Klux Klan, but Lincoln is called the South's best friend and everything. He becomes sort of like a moderating figure, a gesture of reconciliation between the North and the South during that period. And but also I should say his innate radicalism and his innate sense of moral justice is kind of squeezed out by Southerners at that point in the interest of this kind of middling, homogenized American icon. Yeah.
So the memory of Abraham Lincoln is both used and abused over the ages. Lewis Major, you wrote a review of David Reynolds' book, and one of his insights that you reflected on regarded Lincoln's upbringing. The book dispels the myth of sort of a scorched earth life and underscores the great, I love the scholarship behind the talking about the great love between him, his mother, his father, and his late stepmother, and his, I say later, his stepmother and stepsisters and brothers. There was a great warmth, and that I'm wondering if it was innate or it was kind of taught to him in this loving family atmosphere. Lewis?
Yeah, well, I think the point that connects to this idea of his Americanness is also really important here. And David points it out, and many other scholars have pointed it out too. And that's Lincoln is the self-made man. It's something of a cliche, it's something of a trope, but there it is. When he ran for president, he gave some interviews. And in one of the interviews, it was a series of questions, and he gave his birth date. And under education, he said defective. And one of the things so admirable about Lincoln throughout time is the way in which he used education to remake himself. And that's part of the story of his stepmother. You know, he got lucky. She shows up with books, and his love of books and his love of learning carried him to unbelievable places. I mean, the most unlikely of origins and beginnings can turn out to become Abraham Lincoln. So I think that too is part of this story of his Americanness and why he's adopted and valued and even worshipped by so many different sides.
Right. And his relationship with women, Jenny Weber, probably is a function of his loving relationship with his mother, but also his stepmother, clearly, and his sisters.
Well, I think that his relationship with women is a little bit more complicated. He very clearly had a wonderful relationship with his mother, his stepmother, and his sister. But his relationship with his wife was much more complicated.
True.
And, when his children were young, particularly the older two, well, one died as a baby, but he was gone a lot. He would get on his horse and ride the circuit, and he'd be gone for 3 months at a time. And unlike many of the other lawyers and judges on that circuit, he would not come home during that time. Now, what we know about Lincoln's relationship with his wife is really difficult to suss out, because the sources that we have mostly didn't like her. And so what we get is a very particular point of view on what she was like and what their relationship was like.
But in general, he wasn't sexist, right? David Reynolds, he liked women. He respected women intellectually and otherwise.
Yeah, in the 1830s, he said that the vote shouldn't necessarily be excluded from women. Now, this was about 15 years or 13 years before Seneca Falls, and he made that, not that he ever kind of followed up very much with that, but still he made that statement. And he also thought that women were unfairly treated in a sexual double standard, that it was okay for men to seduce women, and then the women were so-called fallen women. But hey, the men are also guilty here too, he said. You know, you can't just totally blame the woman. I mean, come on. So there was a side of him. And Mary Todd Lincoln, now she was temperamental and all of that, and people have whatever imposed, let's say, bipolar, a condition on her. But she was fiercely loyal to him. It was true that, as Jenny said, there were spaces in their togetherness. He was gone for 3 months at a time, let's say in the spring, and maybe another 2 months in the fall. So yeah, I mean, the big spaces. She developed actually close friendships with women and with other people. And I think they kind of achieved some kind of balance. Also, she was fiercely ambitious for him, really ambitious. And during the Civil War, seven of her relatives, because her dad remarried when her mother had died, and those step-siblings became Confederates, and several of them fought for the Confederacy. And when they died, she said, "I was once close to them, but I really can't grieve for them. If they were around here, they would want to kill my husband." So she didn't really grieve for them. So with all the kind of problem, and there were sort of problematic aspects of their relationship, I think, but still she was fiercely loyal to him. And there was a kind of loving relationship. Every relationship has its own texture, but he never, I think, really fell out of love with her. And he kind of knew how to deal with her, so to speak, and she sort of knew how to deal with him to a great degree. So, yeah.
Yeah. Louis Major?
Yeah, I mean, also, she was incredibly jealous of other women who gave attention to her husband. I mean, what we're saying is that we know enough that it was like any marriage. I think it was loving. I think it was companionate. I think they suffered through terrible tragedies together. I think her reputation as a strong woman, especially in the middle of the 19th century, is what led to some of the negativity about her, as Jenny pointed out afterwards. I mean, what right does this woman have to be vocalizing her opinions? But we know that not only at a personal level, perhaps at a political level as well, she and Abe shared a tremendous amount. You know, on his last day alive, they took a carriage ride in the afternoon, and she later wrote about that carriage ride and the sort of happiness that they shared together and their plans for a future that unfortunately was never to be.
I wanted to talk about, you know, what people kind of refer to as the genius of Abraham Lincoln and what that really meant. Obviously, he was self-made. He was self-taught. He was all of that. But Louis, I think you know that he was very open-minded. I mean, his genius was that he took in everything and didn't have guardrails up, and that was his genius, and that's what educated him.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my argument about him over and over again is that his genius lay not only in his interest in everything, from Shakespeare to Euclid, the way he absorbed things, but a mental frame in which he was deliberate, methodical, in which if he didn't know something, he studied it, he thought about it. And my point about him all the time is his greatness lies in his willingness to change his mind. We can see that over and over and over again, the ways in which he was evolutionary. I mean, that's part of that genius. You know, that's part, to the extent that we admire him as a politician, certainly for me personally, it's that quality to hold one set of positions at one time in his life, but under changing circumstances and under the influences of a variety of different sources, to change his mind and be willing to grow over time.
And, you know, Jenny, I think about that because in this day and age, it seems like he would be just slapped down as a flip flopper. That's what, you know, it propelled him to do the many things that he did. But how he would stand up today, I wonder about.
I wonder about that, too, and for the exact same reason, because I absolutely agree with Lou here that his willingness to change his mind or adjust his position in response to new information, changing circumstances, a new set of facts arriving, I think is really remarkable and is absolutely part of his genius. And if you talk about him during the Civil War in particular, you know, you can't talk about him in some ways of being consistent throughout the war, except on a couple of things, primarily that the Union has to win this war, that the country has to stay together. But he's not a still photograph. He is absolutely a moving picture. And the growth that you see in him over the 4 years of the Civil War is both remarkable and deeply admirable.
We're going to continue our conversation about Abraham Lincoln. That is Jennifer Weber. She is an associate professor and Lincoln scholar at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Also with us, David Reynolds. He's a distinguished professor at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. His 2020 book is titled Abe, Abraham Lincoln in His Times. Also with us, Louis Major. He is Distinguished Professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. He's the author as well of many books, including the 2014 biography, Lincoln's 100 Days, The Emancipation Proclamation, and The War for Union. It won the Lincoln Institute Book Prize. If you have a question about Abraham Lincoln, this is the day. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the legacy of Abraham Lincoln and his revered place in American politics, claimed by Republicans and Democrats alike. Daniel Day-Lewis won an Oscar for his portrayal of the 16th president in the 2012 biographical film Lincoln, directed by Steven Spielberg. Here's another clip from that film.
Euclid's first common notion is this: things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. That's a rule of mathematical reasoning. It's true because it works. Has done and always will do. In his book, Euclid says this is self-evident. You see, there it is. Even in that 2,000-year-old book of mechanical law, it is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
Welcome back. Still with us, Jennifer Weber, associate professor and Lincoln scholar at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, and David Reynolds, distinguished professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His recent biography, Abraham Lincoln in His Times, was published last year. And Louis Major, he is a distinguished professor of American Studies and Histories at Rutgers University, and his 2014 biography is titled Lincoln's 100 Days, The Emancipation Proclamation and the War for Union. And Louis, you referenced Lincoln's relationships with the writings of Euclid a few minutes ago. I think that's a beautiful cut from the film to describe how the Greek mathematician informed his views and validated his views that I think he felt innately, as someone mentioned earlier.
Yeah, it's a wonderful part of the film, but let's remember it's a film.
Yeah.
and that films create not necessarily certain fictions, but create scenes that are memorable. So Euclid was no doubt important to Lincoln, but perhaps more important was Jefferson, right? That line, self-evident, that's right in there. All men are created equal. I mean, part of Lincoln's genius was to really fuse the kind of two reigning traditions in America, if you will, the sort of Jeffersonian and the Hamiltonian. You know, the Republican Party is born out of this older Whig Party that traced back to the Federalists, but it's Lincoln who, in the Gettysburg Address famously, but elsewhere, is going to make that principle, all men are created equal, that certainly has backing from Euclid, but has backing in many other places as well, the scripture, the foundation on which America is based. Of course, by the time he delivers that address in November of 1863, he's already issued the Emancipation Proclamation earlier that year, and now it's a process of defending it along these principles, whether they're Euclidean or Jeffersonian.
Yeah, he was a fuser. I mean, David Reynolds, we talked about the cavalier and the puritanical aspects of Americanism at the time. He fused those. He was able to fuse these other aspects. It was, I mean, he was a genius on so many levels. That's just one of them, right?
Yeah, Ralph Waldo Emerson said about him that he was able to span the entire realm of experience from the very highest to the very lowest until, as Emerson said, the very dogs believed in him. So on the one hand, he could memorize Shakespeare passages by the page, and he attended opera sometimes. At the same time, he liked, minstrel shows. He liked sentimental music. And of course, he told a lot of body jokes as well. So he kind of brought all the different cultural levels together. And this was part of his wisdom. And even on the very day that Lee surrendered to Grant, April 9th, 1865, he was on a boat going up back to Washington with a bunch of others who were so excited, jumping up and down. And we would say mission accomplished. And he just wanted to discuss poems about death and from Longfellow and from Shakespeare. He was thinking, 750,000 Americans died during the Civil War. And that's where his mind was. It wasn't all about, I'm the greatest. I mission accomplished, all that. It was really about the tragedy of the Civil War. He had a real humanity.
And then, Jenny Weber, I think about his contemporaries, and Walt Whitman talks about him, and Jefferson, who am I thinking of? Just luminaries of his time that weren't in politics necessarily. And it's hard to imagine a literary luminary of this time referencing a politician and talking about the acts of a politician and the way that, say, I was going to say Frederick Douglass, referencing him and talking about him in a familiar way. And that is a reflection of his exposure to so many aspects of American society.
Well, I also think that he is a central figure, the central figure of the Civil War, and everybody understood that, certainly in the North, whether you loved him or you hated him, and there were people who did both, they all recognized that he was the linchpin figure as the president, as the commander-in-chief, as the person who had introduced the Emancipation Proclamation. So much of the outcome of the war was going to hinge on him and the decisions he made and what he decided to commit to. So it's hard to imagine that I think in part because we have not experienced a crisis on the order that the Civil War was. We are obviously in the middle of a great crisis right now that is rapidly moving toward claiming a similar number of lives as the Civil War. But Congress has exerted itself, and the various states have exerted themselves in a way that I wouldn't say that there was an analog during the Civil War. I think that, Lincoln was just so much at the center of everything in that war. It was impossible to ignore him for anybody.
It's impossible to imagine any of it without him. Louis Major, he's been dubbed a saint. He was not a dogmatically religious person. Let's talk about what his religious philosophies were, because his father went to church, his stepmother, they were all church people, Baptists, I believe. He wasn't particularly engaged in a particular church.
Yeah, I mean, he thought a lot, obviously, about God and the Bible. Read the second inaugural, and it's filled with Old Testament and New Testament references. But he never joined the church. He wasn't doctrinal about religion. After his son Willie dies in the White House, he clearly becomes a bit more spiritual. But, you know, I would go so far as to say his religion was politics. And this is a point of late that I think I've been trying to make in others. You know, it's easy to forget that he was a politician and he was the consummate politician, right? There's this way in which making him a saint wants us to believe that he was just some backwoods naif who shows up to save the Union. But we know that, you know, he first ran for office when he was 23 years old. And he says at various times how the taste was in his mouth. You know, I think David earlier referenced Mary Todd's ambition. Of course, Lincoln was famous for his ambition, right? William Herndon, his law partner, said after he died that his ambition was a little engine that knew no cease. I think remembering that he was a politician, for me, makes him all the greater in some ways, because we think now about today's politicians and what is his relevance to today. Can he be modeled? Well, he was a politician, and some of the characteristics he displayed as one really is as much his faith as the spiritual faith that helped carry him through unbelievably difficult, challenging, impossible times. You know, it's well known that he suffered from depression or whatever, the melancholy is the 19th century phrase, and the need to fight that off and the ways in which he did that is just also something else to marvel about. There, I think a certain kind of spirituality helped carry him through.
David Reynolds took a lot of in reading your book, which I'm working my way through right now, it took a lot of that. I mean, a lot of his personality that I think enables him to do what Lou just said is he got from his dad. His dad didn't get a good rap for a long time, but I was interested in his relationship with him and the innate wisdom of his father. He was a teetotaler like his father, or I shouldn't say teetotaler, but he did drink once in a while. But he was cautious in things, but also a storyteller like his father and very nice like his father.
Yeah, his father has gotten, as you say, sort of a bad rap as someone who sort of enslaved his son. On the frontier, sons were expected to work for the family until age 21 anyway. I mean, that's kind of the way things were, and Lincoln ended up doing a lot of hard jobs on the frontier and this and that and so forth. But when he told a couple of close friends that he actually had a quite joyous childhood. It's true that his father didn't emphasize reading in school but again, on the frontier, it was a much more pragmatic kind of existence anyway. And the stepmother actually denied that the father interfered with his reading and so forth. And his father was a hard worker, kind of hard luck too, because the real estate situation in Kentucky was very slippery and uncertain. And there was layering of land claims. So finally he moves to Indiana where there's government land for sale and things are a little more secure there. I think finally when they do separate a little more is when they move to Illinois and the father lives in a different county. And at that point, Lincoln is really, really rising, so to speak, as a lawyer. He's become a professional lawyer, and the father is still kind of on the same level of subsistence living in a different county, and there's a little more distancing there. But basically, the father had a pretty good local reputation as just a hardworking guy with a sense of humor. And wasn't a drinker, as you mentioned, and so forth. So
during also, a time when drinking was very
like
common.
Universal. The average alcohol consumption was per capita was three times what it was today. And Lincoln gave some temperance lectures. He didn't have to worry about drinking himself. He didn't drink, but he joined the temperance movement and signed the pledge just because he wanted to help out, so to speak. And gave some famous temperance addresses and so forth. So, generally there were things that he shared with his father. Back to his religion, it's true he never joined a church. He did issue 9 proclamations of either thanksgiving or humiliation and fasting in which he, this was during his presidency, including the first national thanksgiving in 1863, because he knew the importance of religious belief, although he made it very clear that he didn't specify any church or any particular religion. He said people should just go to their own churches and pray. And he would sometimes pray to God, although he never pretended to have a corner on God, and he didn't pretend to understand God's will, but he enjoyed reading the Bible and so forth. So, yeah.
Well, he kind of cut his literary teeth on the Bible. Jennifer Weber, I'm wondering when he was growing up through the system and becoming the consummate politician, which it seems like he almost innately was as well when we read about what he was like as a youngster. Did people recognize his brilliance? I'm trying to understand the context of his youth and when he ran for office at the age of, I guess you said 23, was he seen as the brilliant person that we look back on and see now?
That's an interesting question. William Herndon went back and interviewed a lot of these people after Lincoln was assassinated. And so, in hindsight and years later, they're, all saying, of course. That's a difficult source, right? Because they're interviewing these people after Lincoln becomes a national martyr.
Right.
My hunch is that they knew he was different, that it was obvious that he was different, in part because of this ambition that he had, in part because, as we've talked about before, he was really able to straddle the vernacular culture, to sound very academic about it, with the more intellectual. So on the one hand, he's winning great praise among some of his neighbors for his wrestling abilities.
Yeah.
And the fact that, he can win all these wrestling matches, that he is so incredibly strong. On the other hand, he's there teaching himself geometry and later the law, and that he undertakes to teach himself good grammar with a local school teacher, and that he's committed to his own education and his own improvement. And, this is a guy with 9 months of formal education. And what he was able to, how he was able to leverage that. And he was an autodidact, he taught himself pretty much everything. So I think in that way, he was extremely unusual in the number of things that he was interested in and the number of the range of things that he was teaching himself about. Somebody might study to become a lawyer, but they may not be studying Euclidean geometry as well. And so I think that people recognized that he was unusually bright, unusually committed to his own education, but at the same time, he didn't consider himself really above anybody. So he's such an interesting combination of things, I think this is part of what makes him so fascinating.
It's so much fun to just talk about this right now. Talk about someone like Abraham Lincoln. I can't even tell you. That is Jennifer Weber. She's an associate professor and Lincoln scholar at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Also with us, we have two Lincoln Institute Book Award winners, 2014 biography, Lincoln's 100 Days, The Emancipation Proclamation and the War for the Union by my guest, Louis Major, and also the 2020 biography, Abraham Lincoln in His Times, by my other guest, David Reynolds. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using COTA, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the legacy of Abraham Lincoln and his revered place in American politics, something that's claimed by Republicans and Democrats alike. Former President Donald Trump made an unusual comparison between himself and the 16th president during a Fox News virtual town hall at the Lincoln Memorial in May 2020.
I am greeted with a hostile press, the likes of which no president has ever seen. The closest would be that gentleman right up there. They always said Lincoln. Nobody got treated worse than Lincoln. I believe I am treated worse.
Still with us, Louis Major. He's Distinguished Professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. His 2014 biography, Lincoln's 100 Days, The Emancipation Proclamation, and The War for Union, won the Lincoln Institute Book Prize. Also, David Reynolds, distinguished professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His 2020 biography of Lincoln is titled Abraham Lincoln in His Times. It won this year's Lincoln Prize and the Abraham Lincoln Institute Book Award. And also with us, Jennifer Weber, a Lincoln scholar, associate professor at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Okay, let's talk about the media and its relationship with Lincoln. David Reynolds, what was Lincoln's relationship with the press of his day? It was a much different press in its way, so we have to put it in context.
It was different, but they did have the equivalent of, let's say, Fox News versus MSNBC.
Right.
There was a right-wing newspaper press, very conservative. Back then, the Democrats were the conservatives and the Republicans were the liberals, so it was a inverse of today, really, at least on the issue of slavery. Mm-hmm. So particularly in 1864 election, he was savagely attacked, Lincoln was, as being in effect what we would call beyond Black Lives Matter. I mean, he was going to cause a racial nightmare in America because of his love of African Americans and that kind of thing. So there was a real racist assault on him and conspiracy theories and that kind of thing that were directed at him. And then on the other side, he was often criticized, particularly early in the war, as being too slow on slavery. And he kind of had to be, even though he hated slavery, he had to stay on his tightrope. He patterned him.
Looks like we lost David Reynolds temporarily. Your thoughts, Louis Major?
Well, yeah, I mean, just picking up on that, of course, all politicians throughout all time have opposition to their policies from the opposition party, as well as David was pointing out before he temporarily got cut out there from within his own party. It's an important reminder that Lincoln was a moderate. So it meant conservative Democrats certainly railed against him viciously and vituperatively over and over and over again. You know, as David points out, I mean, the word miscegenation is coined in 1864 as sort of to sort of threaten people not to vote for Lincoln, for what would happen if he was elected. But he also received criticism from the left side of his party, the left wing part of his party, who always thought he wasn't radical enough, he wasn't moving quickly enough. So denunciation was part and parcel of it. I mean, part of what's interesting is how over time he would win people over. But not everyone, of course, and that would remain part of the moment and part of his legacy.
Hmm. Yeah. David, I'm sorry we lost you there for a second. Did you want to pick up where you left off? Sorry about that.
No, I think, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, what Lou said was very correct, that he was considered too slow on slavery by the left wing, by the progressives, early in the war. And he said, you know, if we lose Kentucky, we're going to lose everything. We're just going to lose the war. There were certain border states where they had enslaved people, but they were still loyal to the Union. But at any moment, he felt they could tumble into the Confederacy. And he says, we're just going to lose the war. So he had to be a little bit cautious about being vocally anti-slavery, particularly early in the war. And even the Emancipation Proclamation does not emancipate the slaves in those border states, because he really doesn't want to lose them. If he loses them, they lose the war. So, yeah.
Yeah. Jenny Weber?
Yeah, 2 points here. One is that at that time, newspapers were explicitly associated with political parties. The editor and publisher of the New York Times, for instance, was also the chairman of the National Republican Party. But Lincoln also came in for a level of criticism that we do not see in today's press. So I'm thinking specifically, there was an editor, a Democratic editor in Wisconsin named Brick Pomeroy, who as early as 1862 was advocating that Lincoln be assassinated. And he was actually really specific in what he thought should happen to Lincoln. He thought he should be stabbed in the neck. And he was very consistent and open in his advocacy that Lincoln be assassinated. He was on the extreme side, but he was not alone in that. The second thing to David's point is that I think one of the parts of Lincoln's political genius is that he seemed to be out front of the general public, in front of the public sentiment, just enough to be cutting edge, but he did not ever get so far in front of them that he would lose them. And in an era before polling, I think this is a kind of an extraordinary ability for him to be able to judge where the public was. But, you know, anybody could come see him in his office.
Right.
He called them his, I think it was his public opinion baths, in fact, he called them. These meetings with just anybody who showed up. And through that and those conversations, he managed to keep his finger very much on the pulse of broad Northern sentiment.
Again, Abe, that ability to span all these different iterations of Americanism and where Americans were at. You know, I'm wondering if Joe Biden in his victory speech, President Biden quoted Lincoln's first inaugural address, declaring that it was time for our, quote, better angels to prevail. And I'm wondering, given the polarization of the country as it stands now, and people have said maybe hyperbolically that it's the worst polarization since the Civil War, and that's arguable, I suppose. But what do you think or lessons from Lincoln can inform Joe Biden at this time of decision? And Jenny Weber, I'll start with you.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately, and one of the directions that I've been going is that Lincoln had a very clear understanding of the situation that he was coming into, and there was a big effort in December of 1860, so about a month after Lincoln was elected, to figure out some way to keep the Southern states in the Union. And One of the more prominent proposals was that slavery be protected in perpetuity, and that the Constitution never be allowed to be amended in a way that would get rid of slavery. And Lincoln said no. He waved off Republicans from seriously engaging with this idea. He also said the tug has got to come, and that there was going to be a civil war over this, and now appeared to be the time. So there were certain things he was just not willing to cave on. And I'm certainly not advocating for any sort of a civil war, but I think having a clear view of the opposition and maybe not caving on really key principles or things that are really fundamentally important to the country right now, and being clear-eyed about that is perhaps not a bad idea.
Yeah, Lewis Major, you're muted.
I got it. I think it's democracy, right? Biden said democracy has prevailed, and when he uttered that line, he was echoing what mattered perhaps most of all to Lincoln, right? We know the war begins as a war to preserve the Union. It becomes a war to abolish slavery. But for Lincoln, it was always about democracy. It galled him that in response to a legitimate election, his in 1860, 11 states would secede and resort to bullets rather than ballots. And after his reelection, he famously said, we cannot have free government without elections. And if the rebellion could force us to forgo or postpone a national election, it might fairly claim to have already conquered and ruined us. Mm-hmm. So the message going forward is what is taking place today. It's a renewed battle over democracy, over government of the people, by the people, for the people. Biden will engage that battle, and it remains to be seen, of course, what the outcome of it will be.
Mm. And David Reynolds.
Yeah, I think the fact that Biden so far has kind of been center or left of center and has not become inflammatory toward his enemies and so forth, because during the Civil War, Lincoln refused to pour gasoline on the political flame, even though he was attacked from the left and the right. He didn't asperse or criticize his enemies. And the phrases that we remember from him are healing phrases, better angels of our nature, of the people, for the people, by the people, malice toward none, charity to all. And it seems to me that when Biden tries to reach out and kind of encompass, let's say, the people who voted against him and the people who voted for him and so forth, and when he kind of steps away from getting directly involved in the impeachment hearings, that's the kind of gesture that is really needed. It's called healing, and words count. The words of a president count, and they can either pour gasoline on the flame, or they can serve as a kind of a water that kind of douses the flame, or at least tamps it down a little bit.
And to wit, Joe Biden in his recent town hall in Milwaukee said both, I'm tired of talking about Donald Trump. So he was very much confirming his anti-Trump credentials there. I want to start talking about the American people, which burnishes that other bit. I we've run out of time. I want to thank you so much for your time. Jennifer Weber, Associate Professor and Lincoln Scholar at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And also Lewis Major. He is Distinguished Professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. He's the author of the 2014 biography, Lincoln's 100 Days, the Emancipation Proclamation and the War for the Union. It won the Lincoln Institute Book Prize that year. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a great discussion.
And also, David Reynolds is Distinguished Professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's author of the 2020 biography, Abe, Abraham Lincoln in His Times. It won this year's Lincoln Prize, and it also won the Abraham Lincoln Institute Book Award. Thanks so much for your time, David Reynolds. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Wonderful discussion. Thank you.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. Thanks to our All Sides staff, producer Aaron Esmont, producer Matt Rann, our assistant producer Bobby Gerberich, with video production by Nick Payne, board operation by Herb Hauenstein and Scott Good. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson. Thanks again for listening. This is All Ties with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.